We cross from the Tennessee border into the program called Jazz Profiles, heard every Sunday between 2 and 7 p.m. Today, our subject is the bass player and trumpet player, Bill Falwell. This is WKCR-FM in New York.
I hope we're going to talk about the whole gamut here, because there's a lot of, it seems like there's a little clot of time when, with Perry's thing and the Albert Eiler attention, people tend to be asking you questions about 1966 and plus or minus and so on like that. Well, I want to know a little bit about the minus part and maybe roll all the way back to beginning days. Like, there's a lot of talk of Rochester, New York in your early times. Is that where you were born and grew
up? I was
born
in Rochester, New York, and my mother was a pianist. My father worked for Eastman Kodak as a chemical engineer, and they used to say that I used to grow up lying under the piano. My mother played grand piano, and sometimes they had two pianos in the house, and they'd do two grands going, and I took up music. I loved music, and always wanted to be a jazz musician. Jazz.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, now you're saying you absorbed these piano sounds. Did that lead you to come and play piano?
I tried to play piano, but I really wanted to be a trumpet player. I loved the trumpet, and I remember I got a trumpet for Christmas, and I wasn't expecting it or anything. They gave me a brand new Selmer, shiny gold Selmer. Man, it was living.
This is when you're a teenager, maybe, or elementary school?
I played trumpet in, I guess, the earliest you could, fourth, fifth grade.
Right.
Played in the high school, college. So I played trumpet, and I jump ahead of mine. I played trumpet, and I wanted to be a jazz trumpet player, so I hung around with the jazz musicians.
Right.
And there were a few.
Which there were a surprising plenitude of, I guess, in Rochester.
A lot of jazz musicians in Rochester.
Now, I'm not going to start to quiz you about dates, but I know there's one that would be helpful in trying to measure some of these things out. Like, I'm guessing when you were in fifth grade is about 1950, if you're born in the top of the 40s.
I was 39, so.
You were born in 1939.
Right, so I don't have my calculator with me. So you're in charge of that.
I'll accept that mission. So we're talking about you picking up trumpet at about the beginning of the 1950s, the end of the 40s, and you played it all through junior high school, and beyond. In school bands exclusively, or playing more?
No, I played Dixieland jazz, and I wanted to be a jazz trumpet player. So I listened to everything, you know, Chet Baker. And I remember there was a Birdland, you know, here, and the family came to New York, and I made my mother take me to Birdland to hear the dual bill of Miles Davis and Chet Baker. They were on the same bill together with.
Really?
Oh, that was hot.
That's when you were already playing.
I was playing that, so we're jumping around.
You know who those guys were from records?
Records is all there was.
What do you remember about that gig? Just to try and nail it down further, was it you remember who Miles' band was?
It's Lucky Thompson and what's it? Kenny Clark. It was that good band that was...
The one that did Walking.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And Chet Baker was working at around the corner with Jerry Mulligan. So he'd do a set and then leave and go to the other place and do a set. And he must stop some other places, too. So here in between. But and my mother would say, "That Chet Baker's such a nice boy. A nice, clean guy. I want you to be like him rather than that Miles Davis person."
And you didn't go any farther with the explanations, I guess.
No.
Who were your first idols on trumpet from those guys?
Those guys. Chet Baker. Well, I liked Dizzy Gillespie and Chet Baker. I had a strange history. It's not strange, but my father grew up in Davenport, Iowa, and his aunt or cousin or whatever dated Vic Spiderbeck.
You're kidding.
Honest, in high school. So he went to Davenport one time, came back home from a business trip or whatever, and he brought that Columbia issue of the Vic Spiderbeck. They put out three LPs.
Right.
And he brought that back for me as a gift. And
Did you pump him for stories about by way of her, of Bix Beiderbecke?
Was there there definitely are stories floating around, but he was, you know, just a kid then, but he was wild, and he didn't last that long, so there.
Yeah.
But he was hot. I loved his playing. And, you know, I was just everybody. I loved everybody, all music. Just
so here's the
in like a big sponge, you know.
Yeah. The young Bill Falwell soaking it up from every quadrant, from records and from performances you could get to in New York, and I assume from the live jazz scene in Rochester as well.
We hung around with Pee Wee Ellis was on the scene, and Ron Carter was, I think that was more toward the, well, I can't even remember. I was high school, I used to hang out with Pee Wee and go down to those clubs in Rochester and play with those bands. There was a guy called Jamaica Jive. He played valve trombone, and of course Chuck Mangione was around the same time, and Gap,
the both of the brothers.
Yep. And
Sal Nistico, is he from that area?
He's from Buffalo,
but he was playing in their band, I guess, a little bit later. Maybe that's after they.
Benny Salzano was played with Chuck around that time.
Okay.
And Sal Nistico would, he was playing with Sammy Noto over in he was older, I think.
I'll buy that.
Yeah, a little older. They was,
So here's Bill Falwell getting out of high school, I assume, around 1957, 58?
That's it, 57.
Class of 57.
Class of 57.
Then what happens? Your ambition is to be a jazz musician?
Yeah, but I had to go to school first. Got to get that college degree.
Thanks, Mom.
Thanks, and I applied to all these schools, which, you know, Williams and all those schools, which I couldn't. I didn't get in, but I did get into Bucknell, Bucknell University. So I packed up my trumpet and my records and went to Bucknell to be a freshman and do whatever, and I got there and hung out with, you know, found some jazz guys. There was this older guy, you know, he was a sophomore, and he was a fraternity guy, and we talked jazz and beat poets and all that stuff, you know. And he said, Lewisburg Penitentiary is right here. And you know who's in Lewisburg Penitentiary? I said, no. There's one of the, who's the tenor player that, should I tell these?
Gene Ammons you're talking about?
No, it was Jimmy Heath.
Really?
Was in Lewisburg. He'd gotten busted, you know, it's a federal low security, whatever.
Right.
And he'd gotten busted, I guess, around the same time he did those Miles Blue Note sessions. And he was in there, and the guy said, there's a concert tonight. And my friend, who, I can't remember his name, you know, names, he subsequently became the head of Columbia Records, but he was in school at that time. So maybe if you go back in your history, you say, when was that? But anyway, he says, hey, come on, get your trumpet, and we'll go over, and you can sit in with the prison band. I said, whoa, okay, I'm ready.
Concert at the prison or in town?
At the prison, for the prisoners.
But outside people were welcome to come in.
And I think they got me, they squoze me in, you know. So I was just a freshman, and I just, you know, I could get up and play with anybody. I didn't care. So I sat me down there in the back, and then I got up and played my little solos and heard the roar from the prisoner. Yeah! You know, and then the prisoners come out, I mean, the guards come out and make an announcement. You know, boo, boo. So it was pretty lively. And I still have a tape of that concert.
You're kidding?
I'm not kidding.
That prison band?
Probably. Prison band plus me, and they had this one. The alto, Jimmy is, you know, he was a prince there. They just loved him. He was a super guy, and everybody just loved him.
Was he leading the band, or just
he was the band leader? Wrote all the arrangements and coddled them all into it sounded like a real band. I mean, it was a 12, 13, 14 piece band.
Did you know, or would we know now, of any of the other people you encountered in that band?
I have no idea.
Just people who were doing time alongside?
Yeah, alongside of Jimmy, and a lot of them were, you know, I mean,
imagine you understand that. Well, anyway, the first number we're going to play is I'll Remember April. It's old standard. To play a Clifford Brown original entitled Dieu.
some rare music that represents the first known recording of Bill Falwell, who you might know as a bass player. He is here, a trumpet player, looking at age 18, maybe 19. And the circumstances are a penitentiary band at the Lewisburg Penitentiary that was considerably assisted by having available the tenor saxophone and writing talent of Jimmy Heath, who is the leader of the band. You heard him, the most prominent player on the tenor saxophone, joined by another tenor player from the prison band whose identity is not known. He's the one who's having a little bit of reed trouble, it sounds like. I think this band is a little bit smaller, at least the band for the concert that Bill Falwell described to us a moment ago, from which this tape is taken, is a little bit smaller than the group that he had other experiences of, and you'll hear more about those experiences in a second. It's a tenor saxophonist who doubles on flute, piano, bass, and drums. Jimmy Heath, the leader, noticed that Bill Falwell is not part of the arrangements because he hadn't rehearsed with the band. He was just invited to take a solo, and thankfully had his young chops up enough to execute well on Clifford Brown's Daoud, and another item strong from the Brown and Roach catalog, I'll Remember April. Of course, it's strong in the entire jazz tradition. And then our last spot is coming up for Bill Falwell, I think, goes first on a tune written by another trumpet player, Charlie Shavers, in Undecided. So early recordings and rare ones, spotlighting Jimmy Heath, spotlighting for our purposes at 10 minutes after 3 on this Jazz Profiles program, Bill Falwell on trumpet. The topic is Bill Falwell all afternoon until 7 p.m., and the framework is this 5-hour show on WKCR-FM in New York.
So I said, gee, I'd like to come back. And, well, that's kind of bending the rules, you know. So, well, maybe if we work it so that you come in as a instructor, you could come in and rehearse with the guys.
Right.
So they fixed that up for me, and then I came in and essentially was learning from Jimmy, and he gave me his whole book of chords, special chords, and I copied them all down, you know, for all his tunes, special changes, you know, you have to have changes.
Yeah.
Chord changes, man. So I made copies of everything and learned tunes, and so that was exciting.
I should say so.
You know, as a kid.
So we're lucky we didn't lose Bill Falwell in the blush of wanting to be in prison. Maybe you would have...
you mean done something to get there? No, I don't think so. No, no. I've tried to stay out the rest of my life. It's not a fun place.
And it's an interesting view, maybe not yet documented, about Jimmy Heath between gigs, so to speak.
Now, he probably wouldn't like me to.
well, it's, music is music, and you know, people are always in different circumstances, so it's good to know that that impulse for him was still going and was able to galvanize some of the next generation coming up.
Absolutely. Well, if that's, I guess it goes for that.
Now, were you in a music curriculum at Bucknell?
No. I did play with, you know, whoever I could, and I was liberal arts, and I did play with the band, the marching band, and we rehearsed and everything. But I tried to pledge the fraternity that this friend of mine was in, and I didn't make it. You know, well, you're kind of weird, you know. You're not a deke or whatever.
Not a fraternity type.
Yeah, not a fraternity guy. So I was real unhappy, and I decided to train. I said, Ma, I want to go to music school. That's it. Well, I don't know. Well, okay. So I came back, and I was mowing the lawn, doing all that stuff. Where do you want to go? Well, I'd like to go to Berklee School of Music. That's where I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, we want you to apply to, you could go to Eastman School of Music. That's a good school.
Right here in town.
Right here in town. You'd be here in town. You go. So I applied to both, and I actually went to the University of Rochester with a whatever minor in trumpet or whatever and at Eastman, or I applied to Berklee School. Well, the acceptance from Berklee was too late, and the decision was already made, so I was Eastman School. So that's where I was.
So, and this is after a couple of years at Bucknell? After the
one year,
year?
Just, yeah, freshman year was it. I was ready to come on. I did okay, you know, and I transferred all my stuff over, right. But I was ready to.
And you must have been excited. Here's a way to do music full-time.
Music, that's what I really wanted to do. And I, you know, I got my trumpet teacher, the same one I grew up with, whatever, and I could take trumpet lessons from him, and I could do my studies, and, you know, and I got a dorm room and did all sorts of normal stuff. Now so this is where the jazz scene really was. I mean, the same guys were, you know, Pee Wee Ellis was much younger than, he was a kid, really.
Mm. But,
and then Noel Cohn was around there, and the Mangionis, and there's Bill Motzing, Paul Tardif. I don't know if these names mean anything to anybody, but they did to me, because I just, Bill Motzing is lives in Australia now. He's a film writer.
Right.
And
but at
I
the
just
time.
At the time they had a big band, and we rehearsed, and you know, did jazz stuff.
So, and these clubs you're talking about in Rochester would host visiting acts more often than they would have their own. Like
the visiting acts, you just go and hear the people. But they had Pithod Hall was. In the black section of town, and that was where we all went and jammed. Monday night was a big jam session. And Ron Carter was at Eastman at the time, and learning how to play Cherokee and 12 keys or 11 or whatever.
Right.
As fast as he possibly could, and, you know, it was, you know, cutting sessions and all that stuff.
Well, I assume that the jazz musicians, or those aspiring to be professional jazz musicians coming out of Eastman then, just like they are now, were a minority compared to the people who thought they were going to be in symphony positions one place or another.
Right, definitely.
Was it still possible to pursue what you wanted to do?
No. Well, because I wanted to get a degree in music.
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing?
Beautiful.
I wanted to get a degree in music, and they... said I had to be accepted at Eastman School as well as at the University of Rochester in order to pursue my degree in music, to get a liberal arts with a major in music.
Right.
I needed to be accepted. Well, I wasn't accepted at Eastman. And Matzing had since gone to Manhattan School of Music. And he said, you ought to come to Manhattan. I mean, a Wolfgang Knittel was there. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's a German guy who played piano just like Bud Powell. It's just unbelievable.
Huh.
So Matzing said, you know, apply to Manhattan School. I mean, they like people that want to be musicians. They let you off. If you get a gig, you know, you can leave, you can come back, you do all that stuff, you'll be in New York. And I said, okay, that sounds pretty good. So,
so there you go again.
Los parents said, okay, we'll do it, you know. So they sent me to New York with their blessing, and so I went to Manhattan School. I came here, I went to summer school. I took audition, got accepted, went to summer school, and, you know, trying to get a gig and all that stuff, and living on the Upper West Side, 82nd Street, Wolf, you know, put up with it. I mean, he let me stay with him, this could take longer than 2 hours.
We'll
take it took me 63 years, for Christ's sake.
Well, we are condensing just a little bit.
Okay. So anyway, you can run it through the condenser,
no,
MP3?
No. Not at all. Oh. I mean, we're leaving out a few things, your eighth birthday and things like that. So.
Oh, about my eighth birthday. So, first, I wanted to get a gig, more than anything. New York City, I wanted to get anything. So you go down the Union Hall, down to the, what ballroom was it? It's probably still the same.
It's now on 48th Street. So you're
talking about used to be 52nd Street, the right around the corner from Birdland. Down the, it wasn't the Palais. It was, it's not there anymore.
I think I'm not going to know that. Yeah, they've moved a few blocks south, I guess.
All right, so you go down the Union Hall and say, hey, there's a trump player wanted in the mountains. Hey, I got a gig for you, Italian. You ever play a feast? I said, what's a feast? Well, you know, it's Italian kind of thing, and you just kind of march and play. Oh, yeah, I'll take the gig, $30, sure. So I was going down to the village to see somebody from school down in the village and get some, you know, a lyre for my trumpet or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran down the stairs to catch the train and missed the last step and landed on my foot wrong, limped onto the train, and by the time I got there, down to the village, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to make the marching gig. So I was trooping back and forth. Manhattan School was up in East Harlem at the time, and so I was living on 82nd Street and trying to get from 82nd to Manhattan School daily. On my, you know, crutch and everything. It was definitely a trial. But down the street, let's see. So that was a pretty wild thing. So we've left Rochester, have we?
We've left Rochester. Man, we're situated in Manhattan.
Manhattan.
I mean, I guess some of your dreams got to be coming true, I'm assuming.
Now
you're sitting here in the thick of it, checking out the music,
right.
Whatever you want left and right. Who hit your ears when you first came to
New York? Well, you just try to find sessions to go to. They'd have loft sessions. We'd go down to the lofts.
You're saying? The lofts in the 20s and 30s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they had sessions all the time, and there were great players. Chick Corea used to go to them, and Wolf Knittel.
Yeah.
And different guys, and Norris Turney lived up the street. And he went on to play with Duke Ellington.
With Duke, right.
And there was, you know, just a myriad, you know, we were musicians and trying to get ahead, you know, just trying to learn the music. And I ran into some problems, little problems here and there.
Did your ambitions change at all? I mean, in the long history of the Bill Falwell story here that we're unfolding little by little, we're going point to point, but now you're in the Manhattan School for presumably at least a couple of terms, or did you finish your cycle?
I got my degree in Bachelor of Trumpet from Manhattan School of Music.
Right.
So that was, you know, I put that end to it. And
And then what? How many trumpet players who were in jazz have a degree after all?
Well, I don't know. I don't think – no, they must have some, but it just didn't – I was nervous about being – oh, Hugh Masekela was there at the time.
Was that the Manhattan School?
Yeah. Huh. So, you know, it's a lot of people, a lot of players. And there's people – I think I've read a roster of who's teaching there, and there's still some people that were there when I was there teaching. So.
Wow.
It's a – excellent, excellent school.
Who was your trumpet teacher there?
Nat Prager. Nat Prager was played second in the New York Phil.
Okay.
And they used to have a joke about him. As long as the part said second on it, he could play anything, you know. But if it said first trumpet, he'd you know, that's just a joke.
Right.
But he was excellent teacher. Excellent teacher. Excellent. So graduate, and then what's, you know, draft was in session, you know, they had the draft. There was a draft.
Class of 61?
I think so. Maybe it was 62 because I lost a year. I had to go 5 years.
Okay.
All told. So it was 62, and I was waiting for the draft to come, so I just, I think... I worked in New York. I got some job as something just waiting. And I hung out with different musicians, sessions, Bob Zatola.
Uh-huh.
And he was a roommate and still living over on 82nd Street. Just waiting for Uncle Sam to call. And just trying to...
Would he have been the connection to Carla Bley? Bobby Zatola?
No. Carla Bley.
How did you meet up with Carla's music?
That's, you know, going around sessions, I met Steve Swallow, and then I loved, okay, Paul Bley once, went, I was up in Harlem playing at some place, and Tommy Turrentine came in, said, hey, I'm playing down in Birdland, man, come down, I'll let you play, you know. I said, okay, that's great, so I go down, and I'm ready to play, you know. Of course, you wait 4 or 5 hours before get up to play. I played my one tune, and Paul Bley came and snuck in on at the same time and played. That wasn't a connection at all. We just, you know, just a memory.
Right. Just happened to be there.
Yeah. And I played my one tune in Birdland, so it was exciting. Now, I met Carla, and she was just starting to play. I think that Paul and she was still going together. I mean, they were married to each other, but he was doing his thing, and she was kind of back in her loft or their loft, getting her little tunes together.
Right.
And so, and she got a gig at the Phase 2? Phase 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I was her trumpet player, so Steve and Carl and I.
Just the trio.
Just the trio, and we played, I don't know how many gigs, but... enough so that it was like a weekend special, you know, a set weekend.
With the intent to play her too.
You're listening to a jazz profile of bassist and trumpet player Bill Falwell, F-O-L-W-E-L-L. This is coming to you on the program, the weekly program called Jazz Profiles. It's heard on WKCR 89.9 FM and WKCR.org. Oh. One of the unspoken side effects, really, of this program about Bill Falwell is having the opportunity to peruse some of the precious, rare documents of the genesis of some pivotal avant-garde people and some of their first musics recorded. This is a great case of it. You're in the middle of listening to a segment of trio music for piano, trumpet, and bass, where the music and the band belong to the ingenuity of Carla Bley. I believe this is going to be the first recording of Carla Bley playing piano that's ready to hand. Not to say that there aren't others, but this is one of the first that circulates, or the earliest that we know about it. This performance must come from 1962. It is literally a recording that's truthful. The performance part is an exaggeration on my part. This is the tape of a rehearsal for a performance, at least a weekend's worth, and perhaps a consecutive weekend's or a longer stretch than that, at a club called the Phase 2 that has an enigmatic profile in the music. It somehow is just another flash-in-the-pan coffee house that had a little bit of style and distinction at the time, and in retrospect, 45 years later, its distinction is having been a launch pad for a good many of the artists and bands that were significant to the earliest period of coffee house jazz as a support structure for the emerging new music of the 1960s. So, Carla Bley playing piano and playing her compositions, although that first piece that we heard a fragment of is, of course, the standard Getting Sentimental Over You, just to warm up into the rehearsal. Bill Falwell is here, though he is not the bass player. This is the last time we'll hear him playing trumpet, and he doesn't play bass on this recording. He was probably just inching into playing the bass as a regular instrument at the time of this episode, and he'll narrate that as we go into our program farther. The bassist, though, is Steve Swallow. There is no conclusive word from the Swallow and Bley camp about what to call the long blues that you just heard. We'll simply call it slow blues, and it was worked up with the intent to, no doubt, put it into one of the evening's programs or afternoon's programs at the Phase 2 Coffee House in Lower Manhattan. Some of you may know a photograph or group of photographs that were taken of this session. I think a couple of them have been published, and I don't mean this recording session necessarily, but the episodes at the Phase 2 on which Bill Falwell played trumpet. There's someone in some of those pictures playing alto saxophone, Steve Swallow on the bass, and it's Carla Bley's band. She played piano, though Paul Bley appears from time to time in that spectrum of music, not at all on this recording. So, in the process of unveiling to you who Bill Falwell is and where he comes from, we have the opportunity to present, probably for the first time on radio, some of the only evidence there is audible of the Carla Bley band that made the village scene a little bit during that time. And we'll go a little farther into it with another selection that there is no preserved title for, or no known title. The work is still being done to find that out. Carla at the session refers to it, perhaps she's pre-title and maybe we're post-title if there ever was a title, but it was called That Spanish Piece in her voice, so we'll go with that. And another one called in the session is the only one that can be pinned down. It would join things like the Beast Blues and Dance Class from 1960 that showed up in George Russell's repertoire as among the earliest known Carla Bley compositions to have been recorded like this. You'll know many of her other compositions through performances of others, including eventually the Jazz Composers Orchestra and the Paul Bley Trio, with similar in roughly the same time period. So again, music from 1962 featuring Bill Falwell on trumpet. That Spanish Piece, as it was called, where when we pick it up, the band is trying to work out exactly how they're going to get through a certain transition and tempo change, and then through the end of it, and then a full reading of Old Hutch, on which you'll hear a little bit of Carla Bley give instruction to Bley, Falwell, and Swallow. This is Jazz Profiles featuring Bill Falwell on this afternoon on WKCR-FM New York.
that was, of course, great. Then I got drafted.
Right.
You know, from all that.
Here comes the letter.
The letter comes. I said, "Oh, this is good." I go back to Rochester. I'm going to end up at what's over here at the
in New
Fort
Jersey?
Dix.
Fort Dix in New Jersey.
Yeah, I'll go to Fort Dix. No problem. Well, they sent me to Fort Knox. I got sent to Fort Knox. Oh, so. You know, the Army, the draft, or whatever. I said, I'll stick out. Oh, in the meantime, my brother had a friend that was working for IBM. And he said, "Well, I'll send you to program school. I 1401, learned to program the 1401. And I said, "Okay, that's, you know," while I was waiting for the draft to happen. So right. I was passed the test or whatever, and I was a programmer of the 1401, but then get drafted and you go through the basic, and then they said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to be a musician. That's what I want to do."
Right.
Music is it.
Was there a band to speak of at Fort Knox?
Not to speak of. We were in basic training, which is basically
right.
training.
You weren't, yeah.
Yeah. You don't even get close to it. And
did you ever mention, we're skipping ahead just a little bit here, but in encountering Beaver Harris and Albert Eiler in years later, did you ever speak with them about their experiences at Fort Knox? Because I believe they were both stationed there when
nope,
they got broken into.
Never did.
Huh.
Never did. I mean, did they go through basic and then go on, or what?
Well, Albert was stationed overseas for sure. I know they were long. They were in Fort Knox long enough to get wrapped up in some kind of musical activity there, and that's
okay.
Where
here's another the Fort Knox thing I remember now. There was, you know, you have one day off or something, and who's the guy that's the cool jazz guy, piano player right now?
Bob James, or
yeah, Bob James was playing over at the. You know, he was playing there, and I used to go sit in with
him. As a civilian, you're saying?
No, he was in the Army, too, at that time.
Huh.
So I used to sit in with him. You know, I'd take my little trumpet or whatever and go over and play with him.
Wow. Bob James before everything started, then.
Well, it seems. But I was still a trumpet player.
Yeah.
I was still a trumpet player.
And happy to be one, I assume.
Yep, absolutely happy to be one. But I had touched the bass all through my life. I'd also played bass, you know, just kind of messed around with it. And in the training, I think when I graduated, this is coming back to me now. So when I graduated from college, I said, "I'm not going to be a trumpet player. Maybe I better learn how to play the bass better." So I did took lessons from Ron Carter, I think, at that time. And
when you were in Rochester still at Eastman?
No.
Is this at Manhattan School?
Yeah, he was at Manhattan, too. He moved on to Manhattan. He studied there.
Right.
And I might be throwing that out of, you know, the chronological. I can't remember whether it was before the Army or after the Army when I studied with him. But I knew I was trying. No, I was definitely trying to be a bass player well.
And I don't think Ron Carter would have been hanging around at Manhattan School too much after you got out of the Army. By 65, the world was knocking at his door.
Yeah, right.
So it makes more sense.
He was doing teaching and doing his studio stuff, and he was very straight. Good guy.
Huh.
But a serious teacher. I mean, teachers are good things.
You're listening to a jazz profile of trumpeter and bassist Bill Falwell. This is coming to you on WKCR-FM in New York.